So, to our lecture today, Double Vision, the Gestalt of Our Environmental Crisis. And we're very, very privileged to have Mary Jane Rust with us. Thank you very much for agreeing to come. Mary Jane is an art therapist and Jungian analyst, a broad range of experience and interests. And this is something that the Marianne Frye lectures, which are in honour of Marianne Frye, who was a great Gestalt trainer of quite a number of people here and a wonderful colleague and friend of mine. She had very broad interests, and we have tried to reflect her great range in the choice of speakers for these lectures. And I think, I know that if she was still alive today, she would be showing an enormous interest in the whole area of eco-psychology, because she would have an acute sense of the environmental crisis. And so I know that in as we kind of honour her presence and spirit, we know that she would also be welcoming you very much. Mary Jane began her therapy training back in 1979 as an art therapist. And during the 1980s, she worked in a men's prison as well as with women with eating problems at the Women's Therapy Centre in London. She's written, "These two workplaces offered diametrically opposed experiences, working in a male hierarchy with perpetrators of abuse versus working with victims of abuse in a women's collective." And her beginning interests in the kind of seeing broad perspectives, very much in the Gestalt tradition of a holistic way of approaching life and reality. In the early 1990s, she added to that, all that experience, going to Ladakh in the Himalayas and working and meeting Helena Norberg Hodge, a very well-known Ladakh specialist. And I think this impressed on Mary Jane the seriousness of the environmental crisis, with, of course, the added sort of cultural aspects of westernization and development, changing traditional cultures, and all the implications of that for resources and so on. She became an eco-psychologist in the newly emerging field, and weaving together the ecological, the psychological, the political, and the spiritual. And which, of course, is absolutely fundamental to the Gestalt tradition, which many of us here espouse. She's much influenced along the way by Joanna Macy and John Seed. And she's written, "My interest in eating problems expanded in an inquiry into our collective consuming of the earth and the relationship between mind and body, soul and land." So our, in Gestalt philosophy, our holistic vision, which is often not as practiced as I would certainly like to see, I think what you're going to be talking about today, given also that you're a visual artist, which is another side to your life, I think it's going to be a very, very interesting lecture. I know that you've written that an ongoing love affair you have with swimming in wild waters, forest and pond, kingfisher, owl, cormorant and humans. All these places and relationships meet up in your personal and professional lives and will inform us today in this extremely different environment. Welcome, Mary Jane Rust.
Thank you very much. Welcome. Well, thank you very much for inviting me to come and give this lecture. And when I saw just a little bit on the website about Marianne Fry's interests, I thought somehow there was a resonance with every single one of them. And just to pick out a couple, you know, it says Germany and the Holocaust. As far as I'm concerned, we are living through an ecological Holocaust right now. And we know, don't we, from history, how we tend not to talk about it as it's happening, that it's incredibly hard to talk about it as it's happening, because it almost feels like when you stare into the face of the Gorgon, you get frozen. So we have to try and make places and relax ourselves enough to be able to face the horror, in a sense, of what we're living through. And perhaps one of the most difficult things in this particular Holocaust is facing ourselves as the perpetrators. I mean, we're the victims as well, but we are also the perpetrators. And then it also says Gestalt and spirituality under her list of interests. And, you know, I'm sure you're with me on this. In a sense, I'm saying a very obvious thing, that when we can turn face into crisis, transformation is possible. And there's something, for me, taking this path, it has been an extraordinarily intensely spiritual path. So that's by way of introduction, in a sense, trying to link up. So my talk's about 50 minutes, but what I'm going to do is intersperse it with little breaks. I'm going to do quite a lot to begin with, and then I'm going to break for maybe 5 or 10 minutes for you just to be able to digest what I'm giving between you. And then at the end, I hope there'll be plenty of time for questions and answers, because from my point of view, what happens, you know, I'm giving you lots of stories today, really, and so I'd be really intrigued, and I'm sure everyone else would be. The point is what the group makes of this, really. And we're in this windowless room. It's a very nice room, but it does feel like the absolute opposite to, in a sense, my subject matter. So having the images feels very important, bringing nature, the other than human world. You know, we are nature, of course, as humans. But bringing the other than human world and the vastness and the beauty of it into the room feels important. And some people actually, when I've given talks before and I've used lots of slides to illustrate, they say, but they're all the pretty side of nature, Mary Jane. Well, yes and no. I think you'll find that I've deliberately chosen quite a lot of my slides are deliberately kind of double vision. So, for example, this was taken at the end of... I run courses in Scotland, which I'll mention a bit later. And this is at the end of a solo day. Actually, this was in Ireland, in Dingle, on the second course that I ran. And it was the most humongous storm. So this is a picture of a storm being lit up by the sun. This is not a pretty sunset, which someone referred to it about a couple of years ago when they showed it. It's an extraordinary image of this sort of, double vision. So, I've forgotten which way. Yes, there's the next slide. So, we're trying to talk about some very difficult things today. And it seems to me that climate change has come to the point where I think maybe, I don't know whether you share my view, but it's most likely irreversible, and that the best we can do is try and temper the worst of it and prepare for what we're going to be living through in the decades to come. So from my point of view, I think we are facing some very, very troubled times ahead. And, of course, lots of other people on the planet are facing very, very troubled times now. It has begun. They are living through the impacts of Western lifestyles, as it were. So unless a miracle happens, and I'm completely open to that possibility, that something may happen that is completely outside how we think about things now and how the world works. It's always possible, and it's important to leave that door open. But it would be very foolish, wouldn't it, to rely on that? And so we find ourselves in this place of sort of not knowing, but at the same time being pretty sure that we have to take on this very difficult crisis. So a quote from Joanna Macy, who says, "We perceive for the first time in our history the possibility of our death as a species. Facing our despair and anguish for our world is in effect a kind of initiatory rite necessary to our growing up, required for our maturation as a species. This implies, of course, that growing up, in this case, acceding to the rights and responsibilities of planetary adulthood, involves radical uncertainty. It means accepting that we do not and cannot know whether we're here to serve as deathbed attendants for our world or as midwives to a new chapter of life on Earth." I'm going to read that last bit again. "It means accepting that we don't know and cannot know whether we're here to serve as deathbed attendants for our world or as midwives to a new chapter of life on Earth." And this image that I've chosen reflects that. It looks like this woman, I mean, on the one hand, she's just laid out, I mean, it's just the most beautiful image, isn't it, of a kind of allowing ourselves to be vulnerable in nature and be held by the waters of the earth. You probably can't quite see it, but she's about to give birth. She's very, very heavily pregnant. So there's an image of the giving birth there to something new, somehow the whole image around her reflects her insides somehow. She's in the waters of the earth and the baby's in her waters. And I'd always seen it as a very positive image, and then one day my partner said, "Oh, I find that image really spooky because she looks like a dead body to me." So it felt like an extraordinary image to hold what I've just been talking about. Now, hopefully, we are going to survive into a new chapter of life on Earth. But nevertheless, we've still got to mourn the old story and the old way. Something is dying, whatever happens. And there is the possibility of extraordinary spiritual transformation, whatever happens. So I just want to say a little bit about the old story that we're leaving behind. Thomas Berry, theologian Thomas Berry, talks about we're living between stories in this liminal space between stories. The old story, sometimes referred to as the myth of progress, describes the onwards and upwards rise of human civilization. This is what we're taught in schools, from a primitive life in dark caves into the light of reason. And this began as an understandable need to protect ourselves from the elemental forces of nature. But if we think of it from a psychological perspective, this has turned into, over the time, the journey of a male hero who's trying to conquer nature. So it's gone from protecting to using those defences in a sort of overly defended way, if you like, for whom nature has come to embody a number of things, I would suggest, including nature is the all-powerful elemental enemy, something we've got to fight. Nature as sensual temptress. Nature as wild and out of control, needing to be tamed. And nature as unconscious dark matter. In other words, as humans are seen as the only ones carrying this miracle of consciousness, and everything and everyone else is seen as without that. So the hero's solution is to tame, control, and dominate the aspects of nature which threaten, including, of course, our own wild nature. He tries to escape the struggles of being an embodied part of the ecosystem through transcendence, reaching upwards in search of a god in the sky, and he does this by cutting himself out of the web. And I think that's an image which we often see, don't we, in films and stories today about a sense of cutting ourselves out of the web. It's a very adolescent image, isn't it, about freeing ourselves from what's perceived as the sort of claustrophobic matrix of the mother. And I think you can transfer that really into the sort of matrix of the web of the earth. And it's a very powerful story, isn't it, about how and where we find peace and freedom. So this withdrawal from nature, you might say, a sort of an attempt to transcend, leaves us in a place of feeling not so much disconnected, I would suggest, but sort of once removed from the earth, as if we're living on top of the land rather than inside a living system. So the new story is about coming back into relationship with the earth, returning to the joys and difficulties of embodiment and intimacy with the rest of nature. Now, we're very good, aren't we, as therapists, about coming back into our bodies, or a lot of us are, and intimacy with each other and with ourselves, but how about intimacy with the other than human world? So I suggest, and eco-psychology suggests, to live sustainably, we must find a way of accepting the power and limits of the earth and respecting the needs of others with whom we share our home. And how on earth is this transformation of consciousness going to take place? So I'm going to tell quite a few stories today about coming back into what I would call right relationship or intimacy. This is a story I first heard from Stephen Harding at Schumacher College. Anyone who's been on a course there might have heard this story, because Stephen tells it a lot. And it describes a pivotal moment in the life of someone called Aldo Leopold, who started off as a wildlife manager in the early 1900s. And he was one of the fathers of the modern ecology movement. And as a man of his time, he was of a view that humans were superior to the rest of nature, and that it was morally right to manage and control nature to ensure human safety and well-being, which is obviously still very much alive today, that view. One day, Leopold and friends were out hunting, and they spotted some wolves close to the river. They shot excitedly into the pack, and Leopold rushed down to see a wolf as she was dying. He writes, "We reached the old wolf in time to watch a fierce green fire dying in her eyes. I realized then, and have known ever since, that there was something new to me in those eyes, something known only to her and the mountain. I was young then and full of trigger itch. I thought that no wolves would mean hunter's paradise. But after seeing the green fire die, I sensed that neither the wolf nor the mountain agreed with such a view. I sensed that neither the wolf nor the mountain agreed with such a view." He then describes how he watched the gradual eradication of wolves and the multiplying of deer until every edible bush and seedling was browsed, first to anemic desuetude and then to death. And in the end, the deer herd starved, quote, dead of its own too much. And we've seen this, haven't we, in Scotland too. He's talking about the States, actually, in New Mexico. We've seen it everywhere, not just Scotland. So after this experience, this was a life-changing experience for Aldo Leopold. He developed a land ethic which changes the role of Homo sapiens from conqueror of the land community to plain member and citizen of it. And this implies respect for his fellow members and respect for the whole community. Nature was no longer a dead machine solely for human use. Leopold had an experience of being within a greater whole far more powerful than himself. And I think this story really describes beautifully the move from human-centric to eco-centric views. I don't know about you, but I felt really moved when I listened to how Aldo Leopold became open to the wolf in that moment. She became completely present to her as she was dying. It's such a tender moment, isn't it? Such an intimate meeting between, you might say, the green fire of souls. The wolf's no longer a threatening object for Leopold to erase. She's become a subject. And her death, he says, triggers a sense that his actions are not right. And I think this, his capacity now to sense, implies he's now embodied and connected in a feeling way to the world around him. Now he's listening to the views of the wolf and the mountain, and how this startles the Western mindset. And how poignant it is that it takes her death to wake him up to this. And I think this story is a really beautiful metaphor for now, isn't it? In a way, we could go through each part of the story. Leopold stands for humans as hunter, intent on dominating and controlling wild nature for our own ends. But having virtually wiped out all our predators, we're like the deer, multiplying, consuming and denuding the earth of her bounty. And will we too die of food shortages like the deer? We're both perpetrator and victim, as I said at the beginning. What if, like Leopold, we dare to stare into the eyes of nature, to be present to what and who is dying? Can we awaken to the fierce green fire of wild nature, to know that the world's inhabited by aware living subjects, each with their own view? And that means awakening to the fierce green fire inside our own wild nature, which is so often buried under centuries of domestication. Because we are also, aren't we, domesticated wild animals. This is the great joy of joys, awakening to this. But at that very moment of becoming present, of looking into those eyes, comes a tsunami of grief, I suggest, for what is dying and for what has already been lost, for the tragic abuse of the other-than-human world, which is still going on, absolutely, and for the loss of connection with our own nature, too, and the resulting self and body hatred, and a fear that it's now too late to reverse climate change. What have we done to our home? What will become of our children's future? This is the great grief, isn't it? And I won't go through each and every eye at the end if you want to know which all the eyes are, I will. But just to point out that in the middle is what's called the Eye of Africa. It's in Mauritania, and you can find it on Google. It looks like this on Google. And I'll just show you what it looks like, a closer view. So it's like the eye of the earth, really. Such an extraordinary image, isn't it? We don't think of the earth as having an eye. And of course, in a way, you could say that it's anthropomorphizing the earth. It's an amazing structure. That's another view of it. It's a desert, and the blue is not water. It's just a sort of a play of light. So many writers in the field of eco-psychology describe this process of going from human-centric to eco-centric as reconnecting with nature. But I think this can give a very simplistic impression of going back to nature, which often, I think, for people means going back to a state of blissful harmony, a nostalgia, you might say, for Eden, often projected onto indigenous peoples. There's a lot that gets very confused in there. And it also reinforces that old paradigm dualism that we're not part of nature, that, of course we're connected to nature. How can we not be? So perhaps a more accurate description of what's needed is to return in the present to an intimate relationship with nature. And what we know from human relationships is that intimacy is beautiful, complex, and extremely difficult, because it involves all the fears and hurts and losses and griefs and trauma that accompany love in any reciprocal relationship. Embodiment and recovering an intimacy with the other-than-human world is therefore a mix of joy and pain. And it's about finding a way of being with our vulnerability as creatures. Now, in a sense, everything that I'm saying, I know, will be terribly familiar to you as therapists. I don't know whether everyone in this room is a therapist, but I'm assuming that the majority are. But I guess the bit that we often don't jump to because of the culture that we live in is this connection to the other than human. And I'm using this image. It's obviously loaded. I'm not going to talk a lot about the myth of the fall. But because it's still such a powerful myth in our culture, and I think it says so much about how we've dealt with the scary and painful aspects of nature and how we project onto the scary snake and the whole story about transcendence and the separation and being cast out of this place that we're really meant to be in and be able to keep returning to. But in that story, we're not able to go back. It's a very wounding story to have at the heart of our culture, isn't it? So Leopold's story describes a significant moment of change, doesn't it, that was instant and spontaneous. And as you probably know, these kinds of transformative experiences, they're not uncommon among people who spend lots of time in the wilds of nature. And indigenous cultures have always recognised that spending time alone in wilderness can return humans to what we might call original nature. I mean, a term that I would borrow from Buddhism. I think it's a fantastic term, original nature. However, their ritual practices, which have been developed over thousands of years, recognise the need to prepare for, digest and integrate these very powerful experiences into the wisdom of the community. And it's a reminder that we've lost many of those rituals and very vital safe containers for collective change, and as well as a knowledge about the process of change itself. I mean, as therapists, we have a lot of knowledge about the process of change, but how far does that get integrated into mainstream culture? Now, this shift from ecocentric to an ecocentric view can be triggered in many other ways. People who spent time in non-Western cultures may come into sophisticated cosmologies and lifestyles which embody a more earth-centered way of living. Artists, philosophers, or anyone who inhabits the borderland areas may be more in touch with what's been pushed out of mainstream view. And those who have the courage to speak out, which is why I've put the fool in there on the left, are often initially seen as fools, aren't they? But they may turn out to be the visionaries of our time. It takes a lot to stand up and say something that's really going against the flow of mainstream culture. And those people act as a conduit for new ways of seeing. But of course, crisis is also a trigger for change. But it takes many years, doesn't it, for a kind of instant and spontaneous insight to get integrated into the detail of our everyday lives. And in psychological language, and for me and as a Jungian, this involves facing the shadow aspects of self and other that are difficult to own. We've got to untangle projections and invite back in what's been pushed into the margins. And as we know, this is a really grueling task, as well as grieving for what's been lost and making amends. So it's a painful process for the ego. Of course, the rewards are many. So this is another story from Joanna Macy about community grieving, enabling community grieving. For those of you who don't know, Joanna is a Buddhist scholar and an eco-philosopher, and she's pioneered the work that reconnects and offers workshops for people to express and explore their feelings in relation to the global crisis. She offered, back in 1992, a series of workshops to people living in areas contaminated by the nuclear disaster of Chernobyl in Russia. And this particular village was the closest to the disaster. And these people described themselves as people of the forest, And yet, because of the contamination, the only contact with the trees they had was the wallpaper inside their homes. I mean, I just find that completely unimaginable. And of course, the effects of the disaster included a range of physical illnesses as well as explosive anger and grief. Yet the group she was with were reluctant to talk about this. They said they'd had enough pain and they wanted to get on. This was at a stage in the workshop where grief started to erupt. And they got very pissed off with Joanna for taking them back through all of this pain. "Why have you done this to us?" one woman cried out. "I would be willing to feel the sorrow, all the sorrow in the world, if it would save my daughters from cancer. Can my tears protect them? What good are my tears if they can't?" Joanna responded with, "I have no wisdom to meet your grief, but I can share this with you. After the war, which almost destroyed their country, the German people determined that they would do anything to spare their children the suffering that they had known. They worked hard to give them a rich and safe life, and they created an economic miracle. They gave their children everything, except for one thing. They didn't give them their broken hearts, and the children never forgave them for that." The following morning, everyone returned to the workshop. I mean, what a thing to be able to deliver in response to this group of people. It's extraordinary, isn't it? So the following morning, everyone returned to the workshop. And the first to speak was the woman that I just mentioned who burst out. And she said, "It feels like my heart is breaking open. Maybe it will keep breaking again and again every day. I don't know. But somehow I can't explain. It feels right. This breaking connects me to everything and everyone, as if we were all branches of the same tree." One by one, they said that it had been very hard, but now they were beginning to feel cleansed, uncontaminated for the first time. It's really understandable, isn't it, that we want to protect ourselves, each other and our children from the pain of the world. I was 19 before I learnt of the Holocaust. I was so ashamed when I found out. It was terrible. But of course my parents wanted to protect me from the horror. The desire to get on and be positive in the face of overwhelming grief and anger, keeping a stiff upper lip, is part of the old onwards and upwards story, isn't it? And it's a drive not only to conquer land, but also to conquer pain and vulnerability. It's so hard to stay with this vulnerability and our grief. And we know, don't we, that when it's blocked, that it results in all kinds of problems, illness and psychological problems, eating problems and other addictions. So part of the new story, which therapists, I think, have a really important role to play in, is bringing in a more therapeutic approach, learning to go with the flow of emotions and how to ride the waves of grief. And it's a move away from this onwards and upwards linear progress to completing the circle of going backwards and downwards, the importance of backwards and downwards, which otherwise known as reflection. So a loving relationship with the rest of nature inevitably includes the pain of losing loved ones, or trauma when places or creatures are damaged. And often our first experience of death in childhood is the loss of a pet, or a favourite tree which has become a familiar companion in play or solace and may be chopped down with no warning, nor any recognition of the feelings of loss involved. Moving home involves loss in relation to place, and there's also the trauma of revisiting a special place only to discover it's been desecrated by development or pollution. And then the larger traumas such as earthquakes, floods, famine, and the many different kinds of ecocide, they all take generations to recover from, don't they? So in all of these ways and more, our bonds with the whole Earth community run so incredibly deep, and it calls for recognition. Where are our memorials to the other than human world? Oh, actually, sorry, this is a tree on Hampstead Heath, which is just the most extraordinary structure, isn't it? Call it the hugging tree. These two branches that have grown together. So a memorial to lost species, and possibly the first. Actually, they both claim they're the first. One is a cairn just outside Lewes, and the other one is a memorial project in Portland in Dorset. So that's the one on the right, where there's going to be a stone monument bearing the images of all the species of plants and animals known to have gone extinct in modern times. A bell will be tolled when a species becomes extinct. Making the loss of what's happening in our world is an important step towards making amends and rebuilding ecological community. And it's an expression of love, isn't it? This monument on the left has just happened, I think, last month on Mount Caburn. And there's a link, well, I'll give you some links at the end, but there are offers to take people on guided walks from Glynde, and it's about a beautiful 40-minute walk from Glynde station up onto the Downs to put a stone there in memory of loss in relation to the other than human world. So I'm just going to pause there for you to have a chance to talk to each other in pairs, whoever's closest to you, and just have an exchange. Really, it can be anything about what I've been talking about, but obviously the focus on this particular bit is about grief and making amends. So anything you want to share with each other, and just a few minutes each way. I was sitting here thinking I probably could have just given you that and we could have gone on for the rest of the day, really. So I want to say something in this bit about what I would call unlearning consumerism. Cutting down on carbon emissions is also about loss, isn't it? And I think that's why the sustainability agenda is so difficult. And the greenwash tries to make out that it isn't about loss, but it is about loss. And I think most people are aware we must give up having so much stuff. We're caught, I might say, in a giant eating problem. And the trouble is that facing our ravenous consumption of the earth can arouse very strong feelings of guilt for what has been branded as greed, a quality, I would say, that humans would prefer to project onto animals, especially pigs. Actually, I think obese people cop an enormous amount of projection from everyone else. In a sense, they are the scapegoats for the greed that's going on everywhere. And the danger is, of course, that sustainability becomes a new form of diet, the carbon diet. We know that diets use old paradigm methods, don't we, of using the mind to try and discipline the body. Bodily appetites aren't to be trusted, and they've got to be kept under strict control, for fear, perhaps, of insatiable hunger. And body hatred is one of the byproducts of this. And this is a top-down approach which is all about being good. And then the inevitable follows, doesn't it? Breaking the rules to binge on naughty food, a sensual orgy, not unlike the sexual excitement of having an affair. So the carbon diet urges people to live the good green life, while rampant consumerism and life in the fast lane can easily become part of the naughty, exciting, sensual urge orgy of modernity. And I think this is really difficult, how this gets flipped. We know, don't we, that a therapeutic approach goes beyond these good and bad labels of good and bad food to explore the longings and the fears that propel us into consuming too much. And feelings of lack, in a sense, what we uncover are feelings of lack, aren't they? And I think that's very difficult to admit to in a culture which is so obese with privilege and so much stuff, and yet underneath there's so much lack. And the irony is that the more access we have to this sort of quick fix illusion of happiness, of having everything 24/7, 365, the harder it becomes to live through the frustrations of finding experiences which are really satisfying in the long term. And I think it's further complicated in a culture where our status symbols and our rites of passage and indicators of success are tied up with material wealth. So, for example, learning to drive and acquiring a car has become one of the rites of passage into adulthood. It's a symbol of power in our society. So exchanging a car for a bike can feel like you're going backwards into adolescence, losing power and status at an unconscious level, even though you may know on the surface that this is the right thing to do. It's what it feels like underneath. What does it mean to leave space unfilled, to leave parts of the garden unmanaged, to have only what is needed? It's really difficult. And when stuff becomes a symbol for status or safety, feelings emerge in the process of downshifting, and it may trigger fears of not having enough, of losing status, or of feeling powerless or not being seen. And at a deeper level, I think it stirs primal fears of hunger and deprivation. And of course, that's different for different individuals. But I think it's a cultural thing too. So hanging on to stuff is a way of warding off those fears and keeping the dividing line very firm between the fantasy of some dark and primitive past and our apparently civilized present. We need more ads, don't we, that would make climate, excessive carbon emission as antisocial as smoking. That's what needs to happen. Recovery involves asking, what is it we're really hungry for? Spending time in the garden, listening to the birds in the local park, lying on the beach, feeling the rhythms of the waves, they're all experiences which nourish our sensual selves in a far more satisfying way than consumer goods. And such experiences open us up into the timelessness of simply being, as opposed to the frantic doing, compartmentalised into hours, so prized by our cultural norms. And over the past few years, I've been co-facilitating one-week courses in Scotland which offer time in wild nature to deepen an exploration of sustainable living. And at the heart of the week is a one-day solo experience where people go off at dawn in silence and come back at dusk. And it's simply about being, listening, watching, outside, inside, all day. And it's not all bliss, of course. There's lots of fears of bad weather, of being cold, of getting lost, not just in the mountains, but in the openness of time. I mean, how often do we allow ourselves that length of time sitting in one spot in a 5-metre radius? It arouses a lot of anxiety in people. And yet the immensity of the day allows for ample contemplation, in which anxieties and frustrations have the space to surface and to be met and lived through. And it never ceases to amaze me, every single time we facilitate this, such a simple thing, and how profoundly nourishing it is, and how transforming it can be for people. Very, very simple. How hungry people are for the adventure of meeting nature in the raw, and yet how seldom we have this opportunity for this length of time and silence outdoors. And it, of course, it doesn't have to be in the wilds of Scotland. It can be in your back garden. This place helps because I suggest it feels so safe. It's a peninsula that you can only get to by boat. There are no locks on any of the doors. And when you go out and spend this entire day on your own, actually it's extremely unlikely you're going to meet any other humans. And I think particularly for women, actually, it's the fear of men more than anything else on that day, which is interesting, isn't it? And it's kind of sad because you imagine it would be fear of wild animals and it's not. The ego fears what the soul yearns for, to stare into the eyes of the wolf, to meet and be humbled by the mysterious and powerful universe we inhabit, to feel the excitement of meeting Eros in the raw, wild nature, to surrender to boundlessness and to recover original nature. And it's through these meetings that we begin to untangle projections and find out what belongs to whom. Many of you might be familiar with this clip that was shown, gosh, doesn't he look young? And yet it doesn't seem very long ago somehow to me. In this very well-known clip, David Attenborough inches his way into a gorilla family, demonstrating their gentle and placid nature. And he ad-libs on camera. I won't do his voice, I'm tempted to. The male. The male is an enormously powerful creature, but he only uses his strength when he's protecting his family, and it's very, very rare that there's violence within the group. So it seems really very unfair that man should have chosen the gorilla to symbolise everything that is aggressive and violent, when that is the one thing that the gorilla is not, and we are. Exactly. Few humans, if you look at the statistics, which I did actually out of interest when I was writing this, few humans are ever killed from attacks by wild animals. However, millions of animals are killed by humans each year for food, sport, clothes and medical research, and I'm sure all sorts of other things on that list. And thousands of humans are murdered by other humans. So it would seem that the most dangerous wild animal on Earth is the human being. And yet, many wild animals are still killed for sport in order, apparently, to protect humans. This is, in part, perhaps, in order to maintain a myth in which hunters can remain heroes and animals can continue to carry our projections of wildness and uncontained aggression. Now, of course, it doesn't make... To take back those projections doesn't make wild animals or wilderness safe. The problem is about attitudes to risk and danger. The hero in the myth of progress tries to make his world safe by making increasingly elaborate defence systems, as demonstrated by today's health and safety measures. I am now no longer allowed to swim in the pond on Hampstead Heath. When it's iced over, people have been breaking the ice for 100 years, we are no longer allowed to break the ice and swim, according to health and safety. And I'm sure you can come up with all sorts of other mad examples. So, worse still, of course, we kill off the other, the threatening other. It's not just about defending. Yet understanding the rest of nature, being able to read the language of the other, knowing wild as our own condition, is a far more skillful route to safety. Canadian naturalist Charlie Russell, known as the bear man of Kamchatka, has been coexisting peacefully with grizzly bears in Russia for 40 years. He started out as a rancher, and discovered that getting to know the habits of local bears was an effective way of protecting his cattle. He writes, "For eons, the only acceptable way to think about bears has been in terms of them being totally unpredictable and ferocious. And I understood that disharmony between bears and humans was not the bears' fault. It was a human inadequacy brought about by our fear and distrust of them." Biologist Lynn Rogers on the top right has been studying black bears in Minnesota for several decades, and he runs courses to educate people in an area where bears are regularly shot for sport. I don't know if any of you saw the documentary The Bear Walker of the North Woods. It's really worth watching. And it shows what's possible when humans have the patience to understand bear language. For example, a clip shows him standing outside a bear den with cubs, a classic example of a situation where humans should never go anywhere near. And, of course, he knows this bear, which is rather different, but the bear is snarling at him and the cameraman and banging ferociously against the side of the den. And he just stands there and remains totally calm and says, "She's not a mean bear, she's just a nervous bear. Juliet trusts me and she's just worried about the extra camera. She'll do that ritualised display and then she'll settle down." Within 30 seconds, he's feeding her from the palm of his hand and she's friendly and he's able to stroke her. I mean, I just find it extraordinary. Wild nature is often feared as being aggressive, dangerous and out of control. Stories of werewolves, Count Dracula and other human animal characters, they embody our worst fears of our own animal nature. And at the other end of the spectrum, it's not just about being wild and out of control, is it? The fears are about apathy, becoming stuck like a couch potato, or being stuck in a comatose vegetative state, we describe it as, or sprawling out with no boundaries in an amoeba-like state. These are all other fears of wild. And, of course, human nature includes this entire spectrum of animal, vegetable, mineral. Yet the story of our evolution, which I believe is now our current creation myth, would have us believe that we left all these qualities behind in the others who are seen as lower down the evolutionary scale. And we're the ones at the top with this gift of consciousness, analytic thinking, and the capacity to resist instinct. And it's, you know, there's something in there, of course, there is some, possibly some truth in there, but it's all got very confused and we have to take it all out and untangle it. And increasingly, scientific research is erasing the thick line between humans and animals, and our identity as humans is really incredibly unclear. What is it that makes us human? It's a big question, isn't it? We project onto aspects of the world all the time, of course. It's a very helpful way of learning about self and other. But the problem comes when what's been projected out can't be re-owned. And it's clear from the history of apartheid, from women's rights and slavery, that untangling cultural projections is incredibly complex and painful. And for the people in positions of power over, it involves often unbearable guilt for the damage that's been inflicted, as well as having to bear a sense of humiliation. And the psychological work takes generations. I think this psychological work that we have been doing is incredibly helpful in helping us with this next bit about our relationship to the others and human world and what it might involve, because we are the ones in the position of power over. And I think the implications are extremely radical, and it's really difficult to think about how, where we go with this in terms of the law, for example, because it's human rights are privileged over everyone and everything else. How do we change that? This is monumental, isn't it? And the first country to recognise the rights of nature in its constitution is Ecuador. So it's already beginning to happen, interestingly, in South America. It's a radical rethinking of so many of our habits, such as experiments on animals, factory farming, zoos, and the thousands of ways in which we make use of the other than human world. Actually, the friends I was staying with last night, we were talking about keeping pets in cities. And I mean, it's just so much stuff that we do that we take for granted that needs rethinking. It's very, very challenging. And I think what often gets missed in this process of recovery is that we lose aspects of ourselves when we project out. It's seen as a way of getting rid of something unpleasant, but actually we lose something. When the white man projects his animal, instinctual, wild self onto black people, All the colour is taken out of the white man. He's left like a monochrome print, cut off from his colour and creativity, inhabiting a monoculture. When a man projects his vulnerability and intuition onto women, he's left in a cut-off, disconnected world of his analytic mind, unable to relate. When a woman projects out her wild animal self, she becomes afraid of the fur on her face and the hair on her body and her flesh and her instincts. And when we idealize wilderness, we go off in search of our own divinity and beauty and wild mind, flying to unspoilt places in hordes in search of peace and tranquility, inevitably spoiling the very places we've gone to visit. So, another little pause for you to exchange whatever you would like to in pairs for whatever has come up in that piece about consumerism and projections and what we might be challenged to retrieve, to invite back in. Ding, ding. I'm going to just do a final piece now and trying to pull together some of the threads. It's great that you've got so much to talk about. I just want to say some final words about double vision. And about the old story and the new story, really. We know this so well as therapists, don't we? But I think that our culture, our mainstream culture, doesn't kind of realise that the new story is not made by erasing the old story, but out of retelling it. So again, I think we've got an absolutely vital role to play as therapists in this shift from human-centric to eco-centric. I think therapy can very easily become far too private practice. And that, in a sense, the piece that we have to offer, which I think is absolutely vital and is, as you see all the way through, in a sense, our piece about something about the new story is really based on a therapeutic understanding of nature in the widest possible sense. The young male hero who battles against nature is, like all of us, a vulnerable creature who's trying his best to defend himself against the terrors of nature. And he deals with this through trying to rise above everyone and everything else and ends up losing touch with his earthy nature, his bodily instincts and intuition, and lost, you might say, in a cloud of philosophical abstraction or analytic abstraction. It seems to me that that's the quality that's at the top of the hierarchy of the old story, the analytic mind. And his ego needs the teachings of a term that's used from, borrowed from Gaston Bachelard, needs the teachings of intimate immensity so that he can reweave himself back into the web and rediscover his animal, vegetable, and mineral natures. It's a move from being a solar hero to a lunar hero, one who is able to die and be reborn, who knows of power with rather than power over, and that progress is probably a fantasy because everything returns to naught. And it's not really a new story at all, is it? It's a very ancient story that's known by many indigenous cultures. And it's going to take us, I believe, a very long time to work out how this can become a modern story, how it manifests in our ordinary everyday lives. So can we make the leap to become Homo sapiens, or will we die out as Homo industrialis destructivensis? Here's a final story of transformation from astronaut Edgar Mitchell, who's on his way home from space in Apollo 14 in 1971. And it feels to me like it's a great story about our mineral nature. He's contemplating his carbon origins. And he calls this experience the big picture effect. We were rotating and every 2 minutes a picture of the Earth, the Moon and the Sun and a 360 panorama of the heavens appeared in the window as I looked. And he'd finished doing his jobs, and so on the way home he was free to contemplate. From my training in astronomy, I realised that matter in our universe was created in star systems, and thus the molecules in my body, in the spacecraft, in my partner's body, were manufactured in some ancient generation of stars. We are all part of the same stuff, and in modern physics, you'd call this interconnectedness. It triggered this experience of saying, wow, those are my stars. My body is connected to those stars. And this was accompanied by a deep, ecstatic experience which continued all the way home. This was a whole body experience. And when I got home, I wanted to find out what this meant. I asked scientists, they couldn't help me. So I appealed to anthropologists who pointed out to me that in the Sanskrit, it's what's called samadhi, which was an experience of seeing things as a unity accompanied by ecstasy. I realised that in virtually every culture in the world, there's a similar experience. You see things in a larger context than before. And I do believe that is the beginning of all religions, when some mystic had that kind of experience and then tried to make sense of it and put a story around it. Thereafter, I became a peacenik. So I'm finishing there and throw the space open for all of us to speak.
I think we could do all sorts of things here. We could applaud. I could say incredible words of appreciation. Or we could just allow some quiet time and for questions or comments and things to arise. Mm. I think we'll go for that.
Yeah, lovely.
Yeah, but all the others apply. We'll
give you
those later.
Thank you.
And we have a microphone that we can pass, that Martin will pass around to anyone who wants to say something.
Thank you very much. And we were talking in one of those, that last conversation, I think, in something similar to what you were saying at the end there with the astronaut, we were talking, I mean, my word for it was numinous experiences, something about self, the boundaries between self and other sort of dissolve.
Yeah.
And we didn't have time to agree, but we were sort of tussling with what that meant in terms of consciousness.
Yes.
And what kind of consciousness were we, if you like, meeting or blending with or being a part of, and that was being a part of us.
Mm.
And it could be animal, vegetable, mineral, the other. And it was still we're still in, we agreed to continue the tussle about what kind of consciousness we're talking about. I'd be very interested to hear your...
How you would describe that consciousness where you can more easily blend in?
Well, and we're so used to, as humans, of thinking of ourselves as conscious beings. But we were talking about, you know, we might be the self-conscious beings, but we're certainly not the only conscious... We're not the only conscious creation. I'm interested to hear what you
would
say about that.
Well, for me, this is absolutely the nub of it, the heart of it, really. That we consider ourselves to be, that our dominant culture says that we are the only ones with consciousness. I mean, then there's a whole other question, isn't there, about what is consciousness? Anyway.
Exactly.
Which gets us into a very long and difficult discussion, because I don't know that we'd ever, you know, get there by the end of the day. But I suppose for me that the flip is that we live in this vast mysterious whole, which I believe to be conscious. And even, I mean, I think there's a problem in the world of eco-psychology, and then, I mean, I don't know how much people know about the different facets of eco-psychology, because there's a whole movement of deep ecology that's grown up, that eco-psychology, in a sense, has come out of. But there's a very common conception within kind of a certain strand of that in a sense we are the aspect of the earth which is able to reflect on itself. Now, again, I feel like I really question that, because I'm not sure that we really know, and I'm not sure how helpful it is to make that dividing line. So we're straying into territory now, aren't we, about what is it that makes us different, and perhaps that's not even a useful question in the end. There's something here for me terribly important about the coming back to a not knowing, really.
And there's something so beguiling about self-reflection, as though that's the key to everything.
Yes.
And what if it's a distraction from the beingness of consciousness?
I'm really struggling with this concept of the universe being conscious.
Do you want to talk into the mic?
I'm really struggling with the concept of the universe being conscious.
Yeah.
And busily sort of trying to attach all sorts of different things to that conscious state of the universe. And I don't know how helpful that is. It seems to be getting me more and more into just not knowing what really you or anybody could possibly mean by the universe. It then has a universe of will or driven needs and so on and so forth.
It takes us into very difficult territory, I think. And I don't know whether it's in any way, you know, helpful in a sense, this word consciousness. I mean, maybe it's better to say we live in an aware universe.
That seems, yes, a little bit easier.
More useful?
Easier to imagine.
Yes. I mean, I'm not trying to completely erase this, the fact that somehow humans have somehow done in our capacity to manipulate the world is obviously taken to such a complex level in a way that no other, it seems to be no other creature has done. But then I was having this argument with my partner the other night, and he said, yeah, but what about ants? And, you know, he came up with all kinds of other examples of things that other creatures do. But I suppose we've had an impact on the planet in a way that, you know, there's no other creature that has caused such the mass extinction of species, for example. But I mean, I just think, you know, I don't have the answers to these questions. No. I'm absolutely in there with all of you wondering about, you know, for me it makes total sense that we're in something larger than ourselves that is mysterious, that we don't know the hundredth of, let alone the half of, that is aware. I think that's probably about as far as I've got, but I would love to hear what other people have to say about that. So there's three people.
Let's just go back to what Jenny was saying just now. I think you used the term that, I'm not sure if you said we're blessed with the gift of consciousness.
No, I didn't.
Okay. But okay, fine. I've kind of heard that before, but actually that sounds like a real, in a way, I'm not sure we are blessed with a gift of consciousness.
Mm.
And I think that's how this kind of conversation here started, really. Mm. Because so much of what we're talking about is completely unknown to us, and quite terrifying in a way. And we try and make sense of it in this very limited consciousness that we have.
Yes.
And I'm just aware, listening to you how little I know. And with great respect, how little you know.
Yes, absolutely.
You know, and that's quite shocking, really. You know, I feel really, 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 really small, like, what was his name in the spacecraft? Yeah.
Edgar Mitchell.
Yes.
Yes. Yes.
Yes. Okay.
Yes, thank you for that. There's two other people wanting.
Yes, I totally agree what he said. We become aware of how little our awareness and conscious really knows about anything. But that's why I think to actually even use the words consciousness or awareness is it doesn't work, because consciousness and awareness only deals with that very limited bit that we've got. But what happens to this astronaut, and what happens, I was in the, you know, walking in the mountains just last week, what happens when you get this, just this little instinct, it's like an intuition or an instinct, a flash of our awareness that there is something more. Or and I don't think you put into words, because that's where words are only really relate to our little limited existence.
And it's, I mean, you know, all the wisdom of all the ages knows how hard it is to, and almost impossible to use words to describe experiences of oneness or that whole territory.
Yes, and obviously we can use words when we have similar experiences, and this is just on this edge. There does seem to be a similarity of experiences among people, and so there's, we can still talk about that.
I'd like to just draw attention to a question about what about ourselves as therapists, as perpetrators, the whole therapy world, thinking along a Hillman-esque kind of way of looking at things, James Hillman, the notion of privatised psyche that's all inside me lies at the root of a great deal of the problem in that it leads to a sense of self where all the awareness and all the significance is in me, and the world out there is deprived of soul. So our notion of what psyche is, soul, I'm saying contributes hugely. So what arises out of actually the problem itself. And are we prepared to undo that as a profession? There's something for us to utterly die to and to lose control of.
It's huge, isn't it? It's a really different way of thinking. But I don't know. I mean, you know, I know bits and pieces about Gestalt, but it seems to me that Gestalt therapy and theory is one of those areas, one of those forms of ways of thinking that it may not be completely. There may not be such a huge change theoretically. Am I right in thinking that, in terms of being in a field? And for me, being a Jungian, you know, that's the basis of it. You know, that we are living inside the larger self, he called it, with a capital S, but
the
he meant everything.
Psyche, yeah, like that,
sorry.
Didn't he call it the objective psyche?
Well, he said there's a self, a personal self, which is the microcosm of the bigger self, with a capital S, which was everything, of which you could not speak, really.
Because you can't speak of it, it doesn't get emphasised, does it? So you end up with a privatised, the sense of as if just this is what's significant.
Yes, for me, the greatest block in the therapy world is this split between human and other than human. And how we don't think of our development really in terms of human, and the traumas and the joys and the importance of the attachments that we make to the other than human, and the traumas that we receive when those attachments are difficult. I mean, there's just no recognition of it. But I don't mean to. Perhaps there is more in the Gestalt world. I'd be interested to hear.
Yes, I wanted to follow on from that. Really, my interest was in relation to therapy, and you mentioned briefly, you know, how it's a lot of private practice, and wanting to open that up a bit, really. So beyond, you know, beyond the one-to-one, beyond the individual, which of course a lot of therapy is concerned with,
mm-hmm.
and wanting you to draw you a bit on how you conceptualise it, how you envisage the work of therapy or the process of therapy in relation to these huge issues, mm-hmm. actually. And I think that your question about Gestalt, I think this. The idea of field theory, the idea of individuals being intrinsically in relationship with
yeah.
the other, whether it's the other person or the environment, the situation, is very much expressed, articulated within Gestalt. So this does fit well, but it's this sort of it's a sort of paradigm. It's a sort of paradigm clash, in a way, perhaps, between between working with the what? I mean, where do you start? You know, do you not start, perhaps, with the individual, or sometimes when I think about the sort of issues you've been opening up for us, it just seems so huge.
Yes.
So it is about where do you start, and what about therapy? Shouldn't we, you know? You know, what about the political? Or do you see what I mean? It's a bit mind blowing, really.
Yes, it is. It is, and I've introduced a kind of. I've gone through various different aspects of a huge field. You know, and I've just sort of cherry picked a few things to talk about today, and it is vast. Because on the one hand, in a sense, eco-psychology is about how we bring the bigger issues into the detail of our lives, because we tend to think of therapy as being absolutely as kind of intimate exchange, and that thing, that crisis that's going on out there doesn't have anything to do with this thing that's going on in here, my pain. So that's one of the places that I think is really very interesting, how it, you know, that image of the fetus. When I was talking about Joanna Macy's story, is that the crisis out there absolutely infiltrates every part of our body and our psyche. It's just that we're so used to not seeing that. And when I and Ruth, it's a very happy coincidence that Ruth is a sort of done so much organising of this conference, and we've liaised together, because really I wouldn't be here without having joined the PCSR Eco-Psychology Group, of which Ruth was a member, and we met for 5 years, didn't we? Once a month in each other's houses. That was my training in all of this. And we were also, we set up a smaller group within that group to look at supervision in our work. And it was really difficult, wasn't it? We really struggled, because we just kept slipping back into the way in which we always thought about what was going on. And then I think that some eco-psychologists get hung up on it's got to be done outdoors. We've got to take therapy outdoors, which is one possibility, because that does, in a sense, bring... It so changes the boundaries that, you're starting to do something else. I don't think, you know, I think it's also very much about how we conceive of our internal worlds.
Because, in fact, most people do live in cities.
Absolutely.
And so, you know, if we're only talking about things we do in wild places, A, we mess them up, and B, most people aren't there.
Yes.
And that's why we like it when we go there, because people aren't there.
Yes.
But most of the time, we're actually living in huge conurbations. That's what we do. And the challenge, isn't it, to actually find how to live with integrity and sustainability, cheat by jowl, which is how most people in the world live.
And so it's, I suppose, you know, I think Joanna's work has been very helpful to me to understand how to help someone unpack their grief for the world in the therapy session. How to, when you're first meeting them, not just ask them about their history of human relationships, but to think about their history of their relationships to everything. In the first session, dropping in a question in the sense that I might say, you know, amongst many other questions, which may or may not happen depending on the person that I'm sitting with, but, for example, how do you feel about what's happening in the world today? And the response might be completely blank look. What the hell are you asking me this for in a therapy session? And I don't want to talk about it, in which case, something else will happen. Or it might be the unleashing of something. You know, God, I never thought I could talk about this in therapy, because there's this unspoken agenda about what therapy is about, meant to be for. It's meant to be for human difficulties in here and in between humans.
I wanted to bring in your use of visual imagery, because I found in your talk the visual imagery spoke very powerfully to what you were saying. And wondering if that's something that, thinking of contemporary artists also working in this area, can sometimes provide an understanding of that shift to the different way of understanding in a non-verbal language, and how, like, often I can relate very much to that alongside the words. So thank you for bringing in the visual imagery, because that's been very powerful and supportive to me.
Oh, thank you. Because sometimes I think it, you know, everyone has pictures in their own minds, and I think sometimes for people it can jar with what's going on inside. So it's always a bit of a risk.
I don't know whether this thing... Oh, it is, if you turn it that way around. I've enjoyed listening to... I'm Liz, by the way. I've enjoyed listening to what everybody else has had to say. And one thing that's staying with me that has been in my mind is about childhood. And my during my childhood, it was the time, I would say between 7 and 11, when my interest in nature and the environment felt really powerful. And I think I had a lot of time in which to explore and play. And I was interested in all the kind of details. I would know which was the witch's tree and where to collect certain wildflowers and mushrooms, and I had that an enormous amount of freedom, I felt. And what makes me sad in this moment is that I think there has been a loss, perhaps in our current in current children's lives, where I don't know that they have the same amount of freedom that I enjoyed. I walked to school or went to school on my bike, and what I saw on the way or what I picked up or looked at, you know, it was all part of that learning about what was growing and what was around me. I read recently, Liz and I were talking and felt we'd read something similar, and I think it was probably in Resurgence magazine, that those early years of having those adventures and understanding and learning about nature in a perfectly natural and innocent way, if that doesn't happen, it never quite develops in the same way, that there is a huge loss that can never be really kind of regained in the way that it can be as a child. And for me, that's something to grieve over.
Absolutely.
To respond to that, actually.
Yeah.
Okay. Hello. Oh. I'm glad that you brought up children and childhood. Thank you. Thank you, Mary Jane. I'm really inspired by what you've been saying. I work with children I'm a transpersonal therapist, and sort of looking at that image there is very apt for me because it evokes for me incarnation, actually, child coming into being. And I think that I haven't really got any sort of great wisdom to say, but I think there's something about, I mean, I'm working with children particularly in domestically violent situations, so when the world, sort of the physical world, is isn't a safe place for the child to be born into, and when I believe the sort of our ultimate resource as a person is to go into ourselves and back beyond the physical world. So I guess this is all sort of very relevant to me, and how we support, how we facilitate in a way to enable children and then I guess adults to keep that connection, which is a very a basic connection with self, and I'm sort of a bit lost really, but because there isn't really a proper way, there aren't really words for it, but I guess in terms of working with children, that is all communicated through symbol, and children will, I believe in my own experience, to sort of keep that connection myself with something which is very, which as adults we do lose and lose contact with. It's about the sort of layers that life kind of gives us, really, I think. And so I guess why I passionately believe that working therapeutically with children around trauma is, you know, there's an absolute resource which I feel I experience in work with children, and it's kind of connects back to the to the mineral, I believe, back to the sort of star, and the stories around the sort of transpersonal theory that I have learned, which would connect back to our incarnation into being, which I guess comes from myths of stars and the whole sort of creation of human life and human form. And in my experience, children have that connection, keep that connection and hold that, and that's then translates into connection with nature and I guess so that's kind of just adding another sort of, it's the beginning rather than what we're aiming at, isn't it? And I guess the theory of that we're coming from something that we might be returning to, which may be a part of what some people believe. Bit of a wishy-washy kind of contribution. I should stop now.
No, I don't think wishy-washy. I think that there's a couple more points. I just want to very quickly say that I think we are trying to, when you were saying I can't find the words for it, I think we're trying to language something
that isn't.
None of us, we're all fumbling
to
put something into words for the maybe for the first time.
And I think it's something about a communication on a level which is beyond words. It is a soul, a connection between souls, isn't it, in my belief. And so sort of that image, in a way, I guess, absolutely encapsulates that for me. And I think does so for very many. It's a very early... it's something that it is sort of a very early, before human birth, sort of
absolutely.
Image. Yeah.
I was stuck at the beginning of the talk, really. You're talking about double vision.
Yep.
And the image of the storm lit up by the sun.
Yep.
That's going to the heart of it for me. And now just thinking about childhood as well. and I was thinking about this notion of personality, and I think that's not taken into account in this sense, in the sense that I can remember with walking along with my feet in the sand and knocking nails into bits of wood and playing in that sort of way, risking up and down hills, sitting on the top of bits of wood and being quite reckless and quite risky, but also being in my own mind, in my own head as a child and not seeing the world, because that was my personality, much more internalized. And I think that some of us are sort of in our own heads, and some people are much more in tune with nature, and I think that that's also part of our personalities as well as what we learn. I think the DNA of our experiences is what really intrigued me by this. And I was also interested in your other image of the Garden of Eden, where I always thought it was just Adam and Eve. And I was shocked to see all those other creatures. How did they get there? And thinking, gosh, yeah, is all of those part of what's inside me?
Yeah.
I think I'll stop on that.
Thank you.
I got two things to say, neither very definitive. One was the idea of hero that you raised. And hero in many ways gets a bad press, and quite rightly so. And it has, for me, a kind of adolescent sense, both as a species and as a piece of development. But adolescents need to differentiate as well.
Yeah.
They can't just stay in the matrix. Otherwise, we are in just an Edenic, unconscious place, and I don't think that's valuable. I think we have to go away in order to come back. Perhaps that's where we are now. But we do have to, I think it's part of development, not just to only see ourselves as part of.
Yeah.
I think apart from, I mean, there's figure as well as groundedness. We also have to go away in order to return, if that makes sense. I don't know if you have anything. I've got something else to say, but
well, just very quickly, where are our containers for coming back? I agree, separation and cutting free of the kind of matrix is an important part of an adolescent rite of passage. Where do we keep, how do we keep reconnecting back into the web? And I think that's what's been lost in our culture.
Thank you. And the other thing is a story, hopefully a brief one. It's obvious to me anyway, we're animals. The question is, what kind of animals are we?
Yes.
And what kind of animals do we want to be? And I think that for me is where consciousness is. We do, unlike other animals who are very good at being animals, we have a chance to make some decisions about that. And I think there are decisions to be made here. And one story I have just briefly is a story from New Zealand, which is where I'm from. As you know, New Zealand was an island once, broke off from Gondwana land. There was nothing but animals that eventually couldn't fly because there were no predators of the sort that preyed on them. All these birds lost their wings and became very good at and very adapted to the environment which they were in. Until human beings came and brought rats and stoats and weasels and dogs and humans and all the things that prey on these things. And there's one particular animal there called the kakapo, which is a night parrot, the only one in the world, the biggest parrot in the world. And at one point was down to something like 35 individuals. It's a completely useless animal. We have no purpose for it other than to eat. It's not particularly beautiful. It's not particularly wonderful. It doesn't have stripes. What human beings did is find a way of removing this not very intelligent animal to another place where it could breed, where it was safe. And just recently there was something like 11 chicks born and there's something like 110 of them. I think there's hope in this. Now, I use useless, not very valuable, and all the rest of it with total irony, because it is itself And I think this is the best. Mm. This is the best part of what we can do. Mm. But I think you said earlier we have a gift. There's a gift of consciousness or some such. Well, there's responsibility too, and that's where we can do something different. Yes, mourn the loss, but don't just let it go. And I think that's a wonderful story myself about because I think it's actually a magnificent creature, unique, and of no value other than it needs to be here.
I'll be very quick.
Can this be the last one?
I suppose hope is my concern, and I know there's a huge need for soul space, for liminal space, for a reconnection with the earth and a reconnection with those things. And my concern is really about being in that connection and just being an observer to the destruction of our own planet. And the destruction of ourselves. So I know we need to mainline or mainstream that kind of liminal connection, but I suppose I'm a little concerned about people too.
You're saying it's all very well to reflect on all of this, but
I know we need to have that connection. I work with very difficult families, children, and I know what they need, and I know what makes them better is to have space.
Yeah.
With the world in which we live. And my concern around that is I don't want to stand in lethargy and see my world being destroyed.
But that's right at the heart of this, isn't it?
So I suppose my question is really around what else are we going to do?
Well, I hope that lies at the heart of this afternoon's experiential piece.
I think we need to come to a close, realizing that we are indeed going on after lunch, and I think in a very real way you want to kind of interlock the afternoon activities with what you've been talking about so far. So I think at this point it's a pause point rather than a kind of stop. But it is a time also to for us to just connect to, in my case, it's connecting to all the other lectures that I've heard and Marianne Frey lectures. And I don't think I've ever been as moved and silenced, in a sense. And I'm sure that my reaction is shared quite widely in this room. And just want to thank you. And let's give her a good round of applause and then have lunch.
I just have one last... there were a few images that I didn't get in, ancient and modern. And the eyes again, but where am I? I wanted to get to the end. Sorry, that's a queen pod, the start of a new story. Here we are. It just has some website links on that I thought you might like. It's called Ice Lens, and it was made by some artists that went on this ship up to the North Pole. I mean, a sailing boat with scientists, a whole collection of people. I can't remember the project name now, but anyway, they were there to, in a sense, to make art in response to the crisis, and so they carved an ice lens, and it's Heather Ackroyd and Dan Harvey and Heather Ackroyd. Beautiful image of wholeness, really, for the end.
So we have lunch now. I think it's nearly ready, or is ready. We're hoping it is, anyway. It's booked. and then we'll come back at 2:30. And during the break, there is a bookshop, I think, is out there, yes. And British Gestalt journals to look at. And and obviously conversations to be had. So look forward to seeing you back here at 2:30.